now we're in order.
Yeah.
Okay. For the record, Representative Aaron Peterson from District 28, and this, I'd like to thank the committee for coming out to Benson tonight, and this idea started back in the fall to get the field hearing that has that we are now having, that has been going around the state for sort of several years and these types of things, so folks don't have to drive down to the Capitol during the legislative session, and that you can get your opinions and such into the record here as the committee takes effect, the session starting February 12th. So I appreciate Chair Peterson coming out to Benson, and with that, we'll go on down the line, and hopefully everybody will get their testimony in, and if you're not on the list, I'm not going to just change the rules here, but not on the list and you want to talk, that's okay. You can talk. You don't have to be on the pre-list.
Absolutely. I'm State Representative Al Junkie. I think that I know a lot of people in the room. My district starts just to the east of here past Kirkland. So I'm excited to be here and participate. And we try and get all surrounding legislators, if they can, to come in too, because obviously what affects you here is similar to Candiota County or Meeker County or any other rural areas. So thanks for the invitation. I'm not officially on the committee, but obviously I have a vote on a lot of these things when it comes to those four.
I'm State Representative Aaron Murphy, and I represent Half of Rush. I'm Representative Laura Broad. I live in New Brunswick, but my district goes almost to Glencoe, up that direction. And I'm going to ask your forgiveness. I've got to leave a little bit early to pick up my daughter, so I'll be anxious to read the statement for the testimony afterwards. I'll make sure that I don't miss that.
All right, well, let's get started. The first presentation we're going to have is from the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance. And I think there's several folks here. So if you just want to come up to the front here and introduce yourself just for our record, as well as letting everybody else here know who you are.
Chairman Thiessen. Chairman Thiessen, members of the committee, and your committee staff, thank you for coming out to West Central Minnesota. We're very grateful that you came out to hear more about rural health care from our perspective out here on the prairie. My name is Greg Thorsten. I'm a researcher for the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance. I'm going to tell you a little bit today about who we are and some of the things that we'd like you to consider in the upcoming session. I'm an associate professor of political science at the University of Minnesota Morris campus. In fact, I just gave a final just a few minutes ago and started that off. That's true. She's in right now. We could see how she's feeling right about that, too. Yeah. But nothing that I'm going to say today is I'm not representing the University of Minnesota today. I'm here representing the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance. So with that, maybe just go ahead and talk a little bit about who we are. First of all, our board officers here today. John Cunningham was unable to make it. His daughter has an illness. He's our chair. But Jerry Flatable is our secretary. Jerry?
Hi.
Right back there. And he's from Wilmer. Our treasurer is Deb Hillerin, who is from Benson, and she'll be speaking shortly. Our organization actually began in 2002 and 2003 when the West Central Regional Sustainable Development Partnership actually convened four different forums in our region to talk about healthcare. And because healthcare has been on the public agenda for quite some time now, we had a large turnout. And so we had four public forums during that time. And basically, one of the major things that we looked at was whether we should form a healthcare purchasing alliance. Okay, now these actually came into creation in 1997 with the Purchasing Arrangements Act that allowed then small businesses to come together to talk about healthcare issues and even to pool their risk if they choose to do so in partnering with a fully insured partner to create new healthcare plans. And so we actually have the details of what that forum found, and it was delivered in your packet. So after the meeting today, if you'd like to take a look at that, there's some really interesting information in there. But those in attendance at those four forums indicated strong interest in forming a purchasing alliance in our region, and so we went ahead and did that. Whoops, jumped to. And so in September of 2003, in this very location, the Benson Golf Club, we are actually formed, and we've been meeting since then. And so the counties that we represent then are listed there. We are 12 counties in West Central Minnesota. We have several funding partners, and those are listed as well in the handout. We've had significant public support and private support, too, from the agencies that are listed there. Just to quickly give that quick overview, we're all familiar with the spiraling healthcare costs, and that's one way to look at it in that handout that's in front of you. Basically, this controls for inflation is the scariest part of this slide, that we've seen healthcare expenditures increase from $1,300 in 1970 to over $5,000 per capita in 2002. So, you know, multiply that by family size, my wife and two kids, times four, it's over $20,000 in healthcare spending, projected over $9,000 in 2010. And so healthcare costs are truly rising at an extraordinary pace.
And can I just ask a question? Is that spending on, is that insurance spending?
All healthcare expenditures.
All healthcare expenditures, okay.
Yep. Now, the reason this becomes distinctively rural, to get right into that, is that there's a strong correlation between business size and the ability to offer healthcare insurance to your employees. And so we see there that the range is displayed in that graph, that if you have small employers, 3 to 9 workers, only 52% of those businesses can offer health care insurance to their employees. For the rest, it's largely cost prohibitive. That increases to 99% of 200 or more workers. Then that becomes significant to us, because in our 12-county area, over 75% of our employers, our businesses, have less than 10 employees. So that is really one of the distinctive rural features of this healthcare crisis, that employer subsidized coverage hits us really hard, and affordability and availability is a big problem. Well, one of the first things that we did upon forming our purchasing alliance is we decided we've got to get an assessment of what's happening out here with healthcare. And so we administered a pretty significant survey in June of 2003, and we did use scientific sampling. It wasn't an internet survey or where you set them on the counter of a bank. It was scientifically administered, and we did have a strong response, over 400 responses to our survey. And some of those, the results though, were downright alarming. And so, as they listed up there, over 55% of employers in our 12-county region in June 03, and it's only gotten worse since then, indicated that they're either very or somewhat likely to drop their health care coverage for their employees. That's those who currently offer health care insurance. 55% said if premiums continue to go up the way that they are, that they are either somewhat or very likely to drop their healthcare coverage. 11% had already discontinued offering it. So it was very clear then that we are in a crisis, not an understatement, but this is a healthcare crisis. When we asked them, how satisfied are you with the number of healthcare insurance options? Because predominantly out here, we have a very limited number of insurance providers as well. Over 70% said that they're either somewhat or very dissatisfied with that, and 88% were dissatisfied with the cost of those plans. So we have two different strategies that we've been working on. The first is looking at government programs themselves.
Can I just ask a question on that? What health insurance options are available out there? I mean, is it more significantly more limited than...
Yes. This is Blue Cross Blue Shield country. And so, and their market power is overwhelming. So in many clinics, we had stories of providers coming in and saying, here are your reimbursement rates. End of negotiation. And so it's not an open, competitive environment. So from a market perspective, it's market failure by definition, and that it's not a diverse, competitive market. So our strategies have been really twofold. Number one, look at government programs. Are they designed and are they working well for rural people? Because it's hard to develop programs that meet the needs of everyone. And so we are going to talk a little bit about one portion of Minnesota care that we'd like you to consider a change for. And then secondly, we're working with small employers as a purchasing alliance to try and partner with a fully insured carrier then to develop a new insurance product. And so we've got recommendations tailored to each of those. So to jump right into the Minnesota care issue, Minnesota care, then the biggest problem, one of the largest problems for us in the rural areas is that it only provides a maximum of $10,000 for inpatient hospitalization coverage. And the first time a lot of our board members were aware of that, what? and some of them were enrolled in Minnesota care, and they got immediately alarmed. And a lot of them were not eligible for GMAC or medical assistance, and so literally they don't have a backup to that $10,000 inpatient hospitalization coverage. Now, it's no surprise that you folks are really aware of the incredible difficult budgetary situation the state's in right now. And so when we're looking at what can we do to solve this problem, because it doesn't provide for basic catastrophic coverage for a lot of people, certainly those in 175 to 275% of the poverty guidelines, well, what we recommend is that right now Minnesota Care does not allow you to carry a supplement to cover basic inpatient hospitalization above 10,000, and we'd ask you to consider that, that people can purchase a very narrowly tailored product to piggyback on Minnesota Care so that inpatient hospitalization charges greater than $10,000 would be covered by that supplemental plan. It wouldn't eliminate your eligibility for Minnesota Care. You know, it's no secret either that the cost of these of many procedures far exceed $10,000. I mean, an aunt of mine just had a $91,000 bypass surgery. That would be a significant lien on people's assets. The asset stuff is carved very well for rural residents in terms of for small businesses and farmers to have those business assets exempted. But this is a major problem for us, and you'll hear more about that from our two testimony we'll have later.
You said that you
had your newest sponsors that were already enrolled in Minnesota Care. So, from your perspective, do you worry about the premium levels and, you know, the basic program that they're involved in? Were you satisfied with that? Did you catch them? Yeah, overall, I think that Minnesota Care was a comprehensive program with this massive hole in it. It had a lot of preventative and good stuff, but it didn't do the basics of what insurance is, which is provide coverage in case of catastrophic illness. So it's why doesn't this fit? You go out in the private market, there's no product like that. They might cover $10,000 and above the other half, but then it's never paired with the quality stuff that's there for wellness and preventative medicine as well. So that's our primary recommendation for Minnesota Care. The second deals with what we have for needs dealing with our partnering with a private insurance carrier, that together as small employers in the region and farmers in the region, there's some problems with the private insurance industry. They do ridiculous things. They don't have actuarial data. They'll compare, for example, rural Minnesota farmers to those that are very dissimilar in agricultural areas, for example, in California. The actuarial data we'd argue, is largely fundamentally flawed. This was developed, by the way, a lot in some of the cases in Wisconsin and other areas where there have been studies that have looked at problems with that actuarial data. So what we ask is, in 2003, the legislature passed, the governor signed, a bill then that would provide for reinsurance. It took some of the heat off the fully insured partner, because the $30,000 to $100,000 claims would be covered by then that reinsurance. The literature is just full of this as being a very promising development. It said if the state would come in at a relatively limited kind of cost, too, that if that would be there, that could be very helpful for us as we partner. Because then that would help us, it would eliminate some of the that risk for our employers that they're not used to serving. They're not used to small businesses and farmers nearly as much. They haven't catered to that market, and yet we're hurting very much in rural areas because that's where our employer base is. That bill that was enacted, the law that was enacted, had a sunset provision of January 105, so it would need to be renewed. We think it was great the way that it was written. Potentially there could be some adjustments for inflation. If that would be appropriate. But that would really help us go back to our fully insured partners who we're in discussions with right now to get a good, meaningful, affordable product that would fit our region well. I don't know, actually. It'd be an interesting legislative history. And there's actually a caveat based on, too, whether if the money would be spent earlier than that, but that was the latter provision. So,
was it used?
I don't believe it was not. It was not. And it was drained. And then our final request is that other purchasing alliances, this whole notion of small employers coming together to work with that, the state supported that in the Purchasing Arrangements Act. Furthermore, they went to the first three purchasing alliances that formed in northwest Minnesota, southwest Minnesota, and Brainerd Lakes, and they each received $50,000 in one-time startup money to kind of jumpstart this process of bringing people together. Can these small employers come together and have an underserved market better served by the private insurance industry model? If they get some inertia to have those discussions, to pull them together organizationally, is that a good use of public funds? And the legislature thought so for those first three, and we would ask that we get the same type of funding arrangement that would help us then find this a more affordable quality healthcare solution by partnering with the rural area by administering these types of surveys, by having the opportunity to meet, have meeting space, offer reimburse our people for mileage, et cetera. And so then with your support, we think that we can continue to research, do this type of stuff. I should mention, by the way, this alarming survey report is in its entirety in your packet as well. If you want to read a horror story, you don't have to go to the mist. You can actually read this thing. It's not a pretty picture, but it's a snapshot of our region. And that wouldn't be possible without the Purchase and Alliance doing this type of survey work in our region. So we'd ask that you consider these different requests. One deal with kind of government changes to Minnesota Care, one helping us partner fully insured, and one adding us some organizational capacity.
And I probably should know this, but the Northwestern and South Minnesota and the Great Lakes, what's the status there?
None of them are currently, we are the last one standing.
Okay.
I'll be very upfront with you. It doesn't mean that they were not successful, though. For example, in the Northwest, they did have a product launch, and it didn't get as high of enrollment as they needed to or as they wanted, but it did open that market up. And so it's a great story if you'd want to pull in folks from up there to tell their story. It did eliminate kind of the Blue Cross Blue Shield dominance in that region and opened up a little bit more, and it's a healthier market now, according to those board members who we talk with frequently. Yeah, and so right now, we haven't actually, we are still negotiating with a fully insured partner, so we are not in a position yet to where we can go offer and solicit a particular insurance product to the small businesses in our region. They're very interested, I can tell you that. They're calling us all the time. Do you have a product yet? Do you have a product yet? Because the existing products aren't cutting it. So we don't have a number of insured bodies or even a number that way, and so that would be something that we're doing down the line after we reach that agreement with our fully insured partner.
I just have one quick question. You know, I think it's common sense for people to understand when you pool together and spread the risk, it should lower costs. You know, I think there's some common sense there. But there's been a lot of discussions recently over pooling and how big the pools, and I mean, the discussions are very technical. But I'm wondering, what barriers have you seen to your group in terms of being able to come together and offer products or offer services to people to get affordable health care? I mean, what government barriers are out there that are inhibiting you?
Yeah, and it's a combination of government and private industry barriers, and we've written about some of these. We have another couple of research papers I could share with you, but essentially, for example, a lot of the larger employers self-fund their insurer, and they bypass the state regulations, paying taxes. They're playing by a whole different set of rules that we can't play by. And previous state attempts by small employers to pool together to self-insure have been defeated at the state level, by the Department of Commerce specifically, and there's a long story, too, that's kind of been told by others, and that's a rather elaborate story. So that's some government obstacles, but the private insurance market by itself also discriminates against small. The way that we run, first of all, there's less of an opportunity for large profits, and smaller groups might be inherently more risky than larger groups, but that doesn't serve us at all. And we think that we're going to have a more affordable plan, for example, than the Cadillac plans of real large employers. It's going to have to be more scaled back, more affordable for our small employers to be able to afford it. It's probably going to involve more, the literature shows that it's got to have the preventative and wellness capabilities. And so I do think that those products aren't as popular among fully insured partners because their largest clients are the largest employers that buy very full benefit-rich stuff that we couldn't afford here, quite candidly, in small employers. So I think it's a combination of actually government issues in terms of the self-insurance, ERISA covered plans and the exemptions that they have. That's a clear blatant discrimination against small employers combined with the private market, and we really need some inertia to get small employers to be able to come together and bargain as a unit with a fully insured partner that develops a plan that really fits rural residents rather than what we call the Cadillac plans of very large, well-funded businesses with rich benefit sets.
And you're going to combine on there the tax discrimination that that already occurs in regards to smaller players and individual purchasers not getting tax benefits that the larger players get and would pay the price for. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wondering if you could talk a little bit more, if you contemplate the benefits that you're describing, if it's not a Cadillac plan, if you've thought about what that looks like, if you've wrestled with that in your
We have a lot. We've discussed it a lot. And we are a politically acute bunch. So we are looking at what types of things are feasible within a budgetary environment and a political environment. And I'll just kind of lay it out. We do have an attraction to, and this is, could alarm some people, but HSA plans, when they're partnered correctly with community ratings, that would require everyone then, and must purchase requirements. You can't have any of them apart from each other, but if you bring them all together, it would eliminate the cherry-picking that's inherent in HSAs by themselves, and it provides individual incentives for being reasonable about your health care expenditures and your health care behaviors and decisions. So we've looked at some of those, but quite frankly, we're very, very flexible. This is beyond ideology, beyond partisanship for us. We're just looking that our economy is really hurting because the creation of our small businesses is very much being hurt by health care insurance and the lack of affordability in it. And so if we can have a Minnesota Care that works for our small businesses, provides catastrophic care coverage, gives people, it'll increase the number of small businesses we have. And of course, some of those will turn into large businesses, but not if we don't allow them to launch up a startup. Thank you very much again. Thank you.
Well, we're both going to speak, and she asked that I speak first. So, since I'm a business, yeah. My name is Michael Jacobs, and I'm privileged to have your collective ear. I typically don't find myself that compelling, but perhaps in this single instance, I will be. I live east of Milan in Chippewa County, and after working at a sort of regular job for a couple of years, 11 years ago, my wife and I decided to buck the trend and move rather from the rural area to the metro, from the metro to the rural area, and begin a small business. And so we run an organic vegetable farm. And for the past five, now we have two children. And for the past 5 years, we've felt blessed to have Minnesota Care as a sort of backup for us, allowing us to start this business. And it's a business now that during the season employs anywhere from 2 to 6 people. And we spend a lot of money in our community. We felt lucky up until about a week ago, or 2 weeks ago, and after being involved with this group, it was brought to my attention that there was this $10,000 in-hospital cap or on payments. And while I've always known that caveat emptor applies to everything, when you look at something called health insurance, you don't expect that there's going to be a hole this big in it. And so very suddenly, the solid foundation on which we've really built our business, our ability to sort of feel reasonable about taking this risk, moving to a small area, buying a farm, suddenly was sort of thrown askew. Were I to get sick, not only would we lose the wages, because I am the main wage earner in our family, but additionally our farm, which is the foundation of our business, would be at risk. We do own our farm outright at this point, so... So to us, suddenly we were put in a situation where currently we have a liability from $10,000 up to whatever the cost of health care would be, as opposed to doing something else, but perhaps if we were to do something with a high deductible, we would only be able to limit our liability. But doing that, we'd be set in a situation where we'd be less likely to do preventive care. And with two small children, knowing that we can take those kids in, and we haven't, but knowing that we can is a big deal to us, and it allows us, again, to do this new thing that we're doing, moving out here and taking a job that doesn't have health care. And again, to bring this in to a little bit more focus to you, 2 weeks ago when I found this out, I was so surprised, and I began asking everybody I knew, you know, Minnesota Care has a $10,000 limit. And, of course, we as consumers should know this. Nobody I asked who was on Minnesota Care knew that they had this $10,000 limit. Now, that's our own responsibility. Clearly, we as consumers should know that, but we don't. And in fact, what we're doing is we're setting ourselves up where, if we do get ill, and we are able to use that $10,000 to find out that we are very ill, we're now uninsurable from another insurance company to cover that illness, and yet we're still stuck knowing that we're ill. And again, to bring that focus in, I went in and had blood work done last week, and I waited 2 weeks to have this done after finding this out, because I thought, what if I find out I'm sick? Maybe I should get off of Minnesota Care and switch on to another policy just in case I'm sick. And then, of course, we look at that, and to insure our family with a high deductible ends up being $11,000 a year, which is 28% of our annual income, which is, it would be worth it if we were sick. It's worth it against our health, but it would pretty much crush our business. And it would make it where I would probably move back to the cities and get a regular job. So.
Well, and so the committee members, and I guess I haven't even thought about it until now, you bring up a very good point. And one of the problems we have, which I just thought about now, and you probably know because you're an attorney, but in Minnesota, we don't allow corporations to own farms. All the farms are our business. Now, if I was a hardware store in town, I could set it up in a corporate structure that would insulate me from losing the business if I personally was liable for debt. But they can't do that with the farm business because we don't allow corporate structure that way in farms. And so I just thought of it now, and 40% of the economy out here is agriculture, and a big part of it obviously are these small businesses we call farms. And they can't insulate themselves from a catastrophic loss with their cows or their equipment or their land. They can't set up that way. So that may be something we need to focus on. And as we move that way, at least specifically address that instance where that's kind of a probably something we haven't thought through as far as corporate structure goes, where you're at a disadvantage. You're exactly right. I mean, it's one thing to lose your income, but you sure don't want to lose your farm the hospital, or to the insurance company, or whoever picks it up.
And for someone in my position, the ability to insure above that, to be able to take that into my own hands, would be infinitely useful, because it is something that, again, we're on the higher edge of that, 175% of the poverty level, yet we would be able to afford the premiums for an additional coverage above that $10,000. So it's very useful.
We have been talking about that, the cap, over the course of the summer and the fall. And, I think we actually talked about, we've passed it in this last year, up to 20,000, during the course of legislative session, not everything survives all the way through. Did we get up to 20,000? At the end of the day?
It was vetoed.
It was vetoed. Okay, thank you.
And right. Still, that goes from 2 to 4 days in the hospital.
No. You're right. So we are aware of the issue, but this is actually a very interesting way. I'd be interested in finding out what a reinsurance policy would cost. Have you looked into that?
Well, I mean, talking to people in the insurance industry, we've been given quotes that something in the range of $10,000 and above of about $30 a month per person, which is very, very affordable, and perhaps, could be lower. But that is the range of what we're seeing.
Yes, Deb Hillerin, and my husband and I have a small farm south of Benson. I'm a part-time parent educator, and about 5 years ago, we got off Minnesota Care because my husband was reading the policy and saw the $10,000 hospitalization cap, and he realized we could lose everything. And since then, our rates for Blue Cross Blue Shield have gone up between 15 and 18% a year, and we have a very high deductible. So we never go to the doctor unless we're very, very sick. And when we do, we end up paying for all our medical care. So even though we pay $550 a month for health insurance, they never end up paying anything. Because even when my daughter had her tonsils out, that just came to like $2,500. So when you have a $5,000 deductible, you end up pretty much paying for all of your health care. And it's running about a third of our income. You know, it depends on the year, what we're paying for medical care or medical insurance than when we do go to the doctor. So my sister and husband have a place in Brainerd. He was teaching at the college, and then they opened up their own auto mechanic shop. And he quit working at the college, and they started paying for their own health care. And they were paying $498 a month with a $5,000 deductible each for three of them. Well, that was killing them. And now he's back at the college, and he's getting dental care, and they're all in for $100 a month. So that's just, I'm just illustrating this because she was almost embarrassed to tell me because their life in the medical world got so much better. And she knew how much, you know, of our discretionary income is going towards our medical care that really we're not even getting.
So you said $5,000 deductible per person?
Correct.
And that runs, so you're getting a little over, like $6,500 a year then, right, for the premiums. But you never actually use the insurance. Well, the insurance company never pays.
Yeah, because we have to pay $5,000 each before the insurance kicks in. Although we do get the reimbursement, the same rates that Blue Cross would pay. Like if we didn't have insurance, we'd pay $150 to go to the doctor, but because we have insurance, we pay $125. So, yeah. But, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your story. It's really put things in perspective. Great start. Thank you very much. Robin Johnson, is that you? Okay.
My name is Robin Johnson, and my husband and I own a small business, and we farm, and we're about 30 miles west of Benson here. And we just have a little different slant on the Minnesota Care issue. Our whole family has been on Minnesota Care for several years, and we have three sons. And this last year when we went to re-enroll, the form had changed a little bit, and it was somewhat easier to fill out. But in filling it out, my husband and I were not able to re-enroll because they said we had too many assets. Our assets had not really changed a whole lot from the year before, and I had quit my job in town to come work in our business at home, so our income had gone down. So right now we are also looking for another health care plan, and I was looking at Blue Cross Blue Shield. I had some quotes from them, and it would cost us $351 a month for the two of us to have a $5,000 deductible, anywhere between $250 to $3 for the $10,000 deductible. But that, it's just a little different slant. I've been told recently that working assets should not count. We're buying a quarter of land, quarter section of land, and that's where Minnesota Care said the assets were too high, and they wanted to know the value of the land. They could not tell me if it was the value when we purchased the land, the current assessed value, the tax assessed value. They don't even know what they want. So we're kind of stuck there. It's kind of complicated to, with our other business, we sell antique tractor parts, and they wanted to, I have business cards. anyway, we sell antique tractor parts, and they wanted to know the assets from our business there too. Well, this business came about, it was a hobby that went out of control, so we just decided to see the family with it. So we don't really have any way of assessing our inventory exactly, because we sell a lot of parts on eBay, and so one day a certain part can go for $5, the next week it could go for $25. And I was told that working assets should not count for Minnesota Care, but on the application, they ask for all this information. If you don't give them all the information they want, they don't let you re-enroll anyway. So it's just something else to think about. And I did call in and ask for some information, and they did tell me, well, you don't need to answer questions. I don't even remember the numbers. Just do that because that's for MA applicants only. That's not on the application. That's not specified. So it's just another plan.
No, that's very helpful, and we've had a lot of discussion about the application form and how long and confusing it can be.
Mm-hmm.
This is very helpful. So hopefully there'll be some new forms coming out, at least for some folks, in the next year or so to kind of get at some of this issue and limit their size. But
good.
This is very best. I hadn't heard this piece of it before.
Okay.
Any questions, John?
In that regard, you know, we talk a lot about the uninsured in our state. And one number, and you can give me the number if I have it wrong, Chair Thiessen, but, you know, I've heard 60-some percent of the people who are uninsured are actually already eligible for a program that we have in our state. So when we look at the numbers of the folks who are uninsured, and we've looked at the fact that we already have a system set up, you know, the question is, where is our focus? Where should the focus really be? And how do we bring those folks into the system in a way that gets people insured, but also in a way that gets brought out of the system at the same time? So it's a pretty important number as we consider how many people are really uninsured and how we help.
Yep.
No, you're absolutely right on the premise of the point.
I would like to say that while we have been on Minnesota Care, it has helped our family greatly. We had a house fire 4 years ago, and three of us were hospitalized with smoke inhalation. Without that Minnesota Care, we would have been set even further back financially because, you know, even just overnight in the hospital, it's a lot of money for three people. So, well, thank you very much for your time.
Our next testifier... with the Swift County, with the hospital, Frank Lawach, and I'm sorry, we met already, I don't know how to say your last name.
Lawach,
all right, thank you. And we actually had a tour of the hospital earlier today, which was really helpful. So thank you for coming and for hosting us earlier and for coming tonight.
Well, thank you, Chairman Thiessen, and committee members. We're privileged to have you take the time to come and hear our discussions. I have obviously gone over much of this information with you prior to, so I'm just going to touch on some of these items. As Dr. Thorson and the other persons who testified, you know, we have a concern in the healthcare industry as well regarding the Minnesota Care Program. There's a projected surplus of $248 million, and yet I think as our last person testified, it's a little harder to get qualified than it was before. And so we would encourage you to expand the coverage and pay an appropriate benefit set for Minnesota Care. We're concerned that the funds in that program might be used for something other than health care services, and that's not what it was intended for. Some of the other issues that we certainly have felt, Medicaid payments continue to be less than the cost of providing the services. In fact, the recent figures in 2005, the cost in excess of the Medicare payments exceeded $330 million across the state. Yeah, as far as Swift County Benson Hospital, it doesn't affect us so much because we don't have that much of a medical assistance business, but certainly across the state there are many hospitals that are affected by that. From our standpoint, realizing that you don't have much to do with controlling the Medicare program, obviously, about 60 to 65% of our business involves Medicare beneficiaries. And, of course, the Medicare program doesn't do anything as far as coming close to covering our costs. We're a critical access hospital, and from the standpoint of that legislation, we're supposed to receive 101% of the allowable Medicare costs. And with the Medicare Advantage plans that are coming into vogue, they're not obligated to pay us that amount. And so we're asking that you support federal legislation to put that in place so that Medicare Advantage plans need to pay that as well. We support the mandate of moving ahead with electronic medical records, and as indicated, our hospital is in the process of converting our data processing system over to include a clinical data package. We estimate that's going to cost us somewhere in excess of $1.5 million. You do have some programs in place through the state, grant programs for electronic records, and a loan program that we have made application for, and we're hopeful that we'll be successful in getting that loan, but that's certainly going to be of assistance, especially when we're involved in a building project expanding our surgery services. Another issue that is of concern to us, and I think to many providers in the area, of course, is the chronic labor shortage and the fact that you see many young people either opting out of healthcare careers or certainly moving out of the area. And the MNSCQ program, they have a lot of good programs that it was certainly beneficial in training area residents so that we could keep those young people here. We look at lab programs, radiology programs, nursing programs, and we'd encourage you to take a look at the funding that's needed for the MNSCQ program and support that. The other thing is that we're concerned about the availability of or a lack of availability of primary care providers. We're aware that there are a lot of medical students that are opting out of going into family practice or internal medicine and going into specialties because they certainly have large loans coming out of medical school, and they're opting to go into programs where their reimbursement would be better so they could pay those loans off. And we encourage you to take a look at possibilities of implementing loan programs or whatever that would encourage these medical students to go into those primary care areas that are sorely needed. At SCBH and ACMC Benson, we're in the process of trying to recruit at least one family practice physician and probably two. We lost one a year ago last August, and we're going to lose another practitioner this January. So it's definitely a need that we have. And then we talked about mental health services and, in fact, the lack of availability of that, and I think our staff did an excellent job of discussing the problems that were associated with getting patients placed, and so I won't go through that in any detail. But that's the extent of my testimony. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and certainly thank you for taking the time to come out here and take a look at our hospital and certainly the community, and appreciate all the assistance that we've received. Aaron has certainly always been very supportive of our program, and Al as well.
And we did get a chance to ask questions at the hospital. I don't know if you have other questions if you wanted to ask. Well, thank you again for hosting us, and it was really helpful.
It's our pleasure. Thank you very much.
Next, we move past the different type of area, but Eric Everson? Everson? Yes, and we met on the
Yes, we did. Okay.
Well, thank you for coming. If you could just introduce yourself to the record.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Chair Tyson and Minnie. I was down in Jackson. I attended the subcommittee, the long-term care subcommittee that was meeting there, so I won't go into reiterate everything they had in their testimony. I think a lot of things were heard there, a lot of personal testimony from residents and families and staff about a lot of the issues. I think I'll just sum and maybe just talk about some of the more local issues we have here. You guys have heard a lot about the funding issues of long-term care. Last Thursday you heard from our trade associations, both MAHA and care providers, that are working together as a long-term care imperative to work on funding. They've been working together for a number of years now, but in light of that, we still have a huge gap. I think we've seen just in this past year a gap from about what they've estimated as about $20 on average between the cost of delivering care versus the cost of what we get reimbursed to about, I think, close to $25 over this past year. And that's due to, I think, we got overall, I think, well less than 2% in rate increases. I think we said over the last several years, we've seen maybe a total of, I think less than 6%. And when you look at the cost of, like we've talked about people giving testimony earlier, the cost of health care insurance, the cost of fuel, the cost of food, the cost of supplies, those are exceeding at much higher inflationary rates than what we've seen in rate increases. What we're seeing in our local nursing home, which is right across the street, you passed that on the way. When you look at how we budget from year to year, The last several years, we actually budgeted to lose money. And we're a nursing home, we're a service industry, but we're still a business. Whether you're for-profit, non-profit, or whatever, you still have to make, you still have to have income higher than what you, when you, your expenses. And if we continue to have to budget to lose money, that runs the risk of this nursing home no longer existing. And as you can see, there's a number of people that are interested that, that have followed me and that are sitting in the back. There's probably also a number of other people in this room that have some stake within this community with this home. And the reason why they came is because they too, as we talk about these things, they wanted to impress upon you the importance of funding long-term care, because this is their home, this is where they live, and they want to make sure these services continue to be available. In our home, when I estimate the cost just over this past year, we're probably not as unfortunate as the average in the state, but we still see at least a $14 to $15 gap between what it costs us on average for a nursing home per day per resident versus what our revenue is through Medicaid, Medicaid funding. And that also includes our private pays, you know, about the rate equalization laws. So we can't just increase our prices. That's not how it works. One resident back there has been in our nursing home for about 8 years. She's 102 years old, and she's sharper than I'll probably ever be. So getting older does not necessarily mean that you become, you know. Yes. But she, along with the brothers, are the reason why I keep showing up. Yeah. Yeah. So just to let
you proud of it.
Yeah. Just to let you know how important this issue is to her. She's probably probably the Minnesota Twins' number one fan, and probably unchallenged at probably being one of the oldest. She had the opportunity last year when the Twins came to town to go visit them. She declined that opportunity because going the few blocks to downtown was a little too much work, and that was in the summertime. I briefly told her about what was going on today. It was a chance to talk about nursing home services. Without hesitation, she said, sure, you can take me out in the cold and walk me across the parking lot to the snow and ice, and I'll gladly come. And so here she is, even at the risk of being late for supper. I don't know how to put in a lot of detail. You have a lot of the numbers, but to keep it short, and it's very important. We're not making it. We've got a proposal out through the moratorium process to build a new home, build a new campus. We want to really enhance the quality of services. You've heard from Frank. You've seen the hospital. This community has done a lot to be proactive in really stepping up and being state of the art, and we want to follow suit. We want to do something innovative. We want to provide excellent care for our residents. And we can go through the process. We can get some of those funds. We can maybe even get the owners and talk them into building a building. But if we don't get the funding to fund the operations on a day-to-day basis, it will be in vain, because we won't be able to continue year to year, and we'll still be at risk for closing our doors. So I think it was the long-term care imperative throughout that they'd like to see at least 3% on top of what we're doing. I think that's still not enough. I mean, we've got our baby boomers coming. They're here now. We had Tom Glassby out here, our state demographer, to talk about Swift County, what we're doing out here. It's not unlike what's happening in the rest of the state. Our population, our senior population, is about to explode, and a lot of those people are going to need our services. The hospital is expanding. They're going to be doing a lot of orthopedic surgeries, which we're very happy for. But that also means that they're going to need post-acute care, and we're going to need to be able to provide that service. So,
what other facilities are or services are available kind of in this area aside from kind of the nursing home and acute care? What other long-term care services are?
Long-term care services. Well, there are. There's a home care agency, which I believe is kind of hospital-based. And then we also have, I think there's another firm in town, Divine out of Wilmer that has opened up an office to provide some home care. There are some senior housing projects. There's a couple smaller ones that I think actually fall under a foster care license, but they house for up to 10 people. There's a couple of those in town. There are not specifically necessary for seniors, but they're through the HUD program for subsidized housing. We've got our high rise in town, which houses about 60 people. Make a fair number also on our Westwood campus. The Fuller seeing some vacancy issues. Those are also aged buildings, but they're not necessarily set up for adequate assisted living services, although they are providing some assisted living through home care services. And that's what we're seeing under demand. Our building that we have here is a 43-unit skilled nursing facility and a 26-unit board and care. The board and care is pretty much an obsolete license out there. We've looked at that part of the building is about 1958. It's more like an old dormitory. They still have three-bed wards, and a lot of those rooms don't even have their bathroom. Despite that, we're full, and we oftentimes have a waiting list. We rely on Medicaid because we would have a larger Medicare census, but people don't want to go home, even though the building isn't that great, because of the services we provide, because of the activity programs. Other places they might be isolated, so they stay. And when they stay and we don't have the turnover, you can even hear from Frank, there's frustration from the doctors that a lot of our residents end up in other communities, sometimes up in Starbuck or Glenwood, but there's some representatives from here too, and they might even be a little thankful sometimes if we get some people from our area. But a lot of those people, they prefer to stay home, and so we run into those situations. So we're two fronts. We're trying to get a new building, but we also need to be able to operate it. So. Yeah. And part of that new building is developing some assisted living campus. We want to add some assisted living. Yes, that's where part of the gap is. We've looked at trying to remodel the board and care. That would also cost a lot of money. We'd have to rebuild it on an old building on a locked land area, which we found it wasn't feasible. And it also wouldn't give us the opportunity to be able to provide the wider range of services. That's why we're looking at expanding into a homeless campus. So.
Yeah. Well, I was just piggybacking on some of the talk that we heard earlier about staffing challenges, and in my own community, staffing for nursing homes is a huge issue. So I'm wondering, do you have staffing challenges? Do you have competition with nursing homes with the hospitals and other? What is the situation?
Well, I can't say that it's directly competition with the hospital. Yes, we have nursing shortages. You might say we compete for the same staff. But when it comes to nursing assistant work and things like that, it's competing against almost any other industry. There are gaps between what hospitals are able to pay and what nursing homes are able to pay, and I think those statistics were brought up also on Thursday. It's quite a gap. And with the funding is, you see through the legislation year to year, that's what we have pretty much earmarked. And a lot of times that's less than 2%, I think. I'm working on giving about a 2.5% increase this year. Last year I was able to give about 3. Before that we saw wage freezes because there wasn't funding. And I think trying to stretch that out into 2.5 is putting us at risk, because a lot of other nursing homes aren't even able to do that. As far as the competition, for some of the frontline staff, whether it be for housekeeping, for cooks, for aides, for nursing assistants, we're competing against just a living wage. I think you heard testimony from one person who I think was a nursing assistant or something, said that they talked to somebody who, well, no, it was a family member who was talking about a nursing assistant, who said that they can make more money caring for pigs than they could for elderly. It was a pretty bold statement, but that's the kind of things. If it's more economical, or it's an easier job, or you can get more hours and maybe better benefits by going and frying French fries and flipping burgers, that makes it hard to compete, because it's not an easy job. It's a tough job. It takes a special person to do it. And when a lot of times, predominantly, those are female workers. That's just the way it is. As a matter of fact, in our nursing home, is probably even more representative of the female population. Other side, the gentleman who works in our housekeeping and our maintenance supervisor and me, that's the rest of our workforce is female. And a lot of those people are comprised of single mothers. So when you look at somebody who maybe makes up to $10 an hour has to deal with health insurance costs for not just themselves, but for their family and daycare costs and other living expenses. You can't make it, and that's the challenge that we face.
We've talked about the building, and I'm just wondering, how's that being significantly expensive? But you, you tend to be, or going for leadership in environment and energy, the lead, is that
yes.
The one? Mm-hmm. So you're going to need like lead, silver, platinum, or gold?
Well, we're going everything we can with this. I mean, part of my proposal, and, you know, it's all going to come down to what's feasible once we hit the funding and also what our owners can do. But what I've been presenting from the beginning is to try to do something very innovative, something very green. This community's been very proactive on that, and so I'd like to follow suit. We're talking about LEED certification. We're looking at all kinds of things that we can do to make this as little of a footprint and efficient as possible, as well as also looking at what we call like lean healthcare design, other types of things where we create staffing efficiencies and other things that help reduce that overall cost. Which, if we can do that, you know, that'll help on one end be able to lessen our operating expenses in the long run. But
yes.
Is
it what about in the redesign? I mean, what about dimension? Those kind of issues. Is that, are you seeing increase, or was the design revolve around that at all?
Yes. That's a big issue too. In our immediate area, we don't really have anything that's specialized for Alzheimer's or dementia care. That is something we're incorporating into our design. Right now, if we have somebody that meets the criteria, that meets those needs, and we're not able to, like if they're in huge elopement risk or have certain behaviors that we're unable to deal with in our population, we have to refer those to outside this area. So.
Is the best thing in the utility shown interest in maybe showcasing this in the Missouri River Energy Service utility generation, that this could be a example of what's happening in places with a LEED certified building in Benson would be an example for that utility to profile the direction that rural towns can go with good leadership.
I think that's a different possibility. I guess a lot of our conversations haven't gone specifically to that. I have worked in conjunction with the city. I've met with Frank on occasion from the hospital and trying to figure out how to collaborate so that we're not necessarily competing for services, but trying to create, a good service industry that we don't have service gaps. I've spoke with the city a lot about the plans. They've been very favorable to work with, but I guess we haven't specifically talked about that agenda, I guess.
Chair Keith has heard the state of the report that we had the opportunity to remodel our nursing home, which is a nonprofit organization, and build an assisted living facility. And the city's participation was not was interesting. It was creative, I think, and I hope it's a model that more and more of these facilities will start to recognize and use. In that, the financials all work, with the exception of they needed a little bit of push to get over the top. So what we're able to do is participate with the organization in a way that provided our city backing in a revenue bond approach, but didn't put the taxpayers on the line for the dollars in the end. And so it's a really creative way of getting something done. And I think from a city standpoint, we really recognize the importance of having a facility like the one you have in our community. And I assume the same recognition in this community as well. So I just wanted to give that suggestion to you. And then secondarily from that, we talk a lot about funding and we talk a lot about the needs for nursing home funding, and they are absolutely crucial. There's no doubt about it. And I think it's fair to say that it's not a bipartisan support in that direction. But having said that, priorities, I think unfortunately in the last session, there's a lot of good things in the bill, but I think the right priority put on nursing homes was much less than it ought to have been. When you look at the increases that were put into the healthcare spending, and you look at the increases of this committee in the finance committee of the healthcare state, put in place, it was, in my view, it missed the target on long-term care. So I'm hoping that we can start walking the talk on this one. We've been talking about it for a while, and we certainly need to move in the right direction. It should have been done last year. Unfortunately, we're going to see the discussion move forward again this year. But it should have been done in the finance year. It should have been done in the last health care budget. And I think the priorities need to be kind of placed as far as long-term care. So I'm a board member of a long-term care facility in Arlington. I see the impact. I see the need firsthand as we all do in different ways. We've got to start walking the talk.
Thank you. And that is what I implore you to do. I've been in this industry for over 20 years, and especially these last few years, I've seen it go from Rule 50 to APS, the changing of the systems, and every year I become more and more frustrated because it just gets harder and harder to figure out how we're going to survive. And so the time is now, and it's only going to get worse with the changing of the demographics of our population. So I encourage you to do everything you can to really put long-term care and then funding at the top of the list.
Yeah, I think it is a concern on a bipartisan basis. I guess a couple things I would say that the legislature actually did pass a more significant investment in long-term care, but at the end of the day, the governor's office was squeezing hard on spending in the health and human services area, and actually we spent nearly half of our money, new general fund money, that we allocated on long-term care and on the COLA increases. And so I think we recognized in the original bill that we passed the priority that we need to place on this, and I hope that we can work with the governor going forward to make sure that we can try to do something this year, because we do need to make up. You know, it's not just this year, but it was the zero funding increases that we had in the 2003 and 2004 session. And it was 4 years prior to this last budget year, I think, on average, we increased much less than 2%. So this is a long-standing problem. We actually have a lot to catch up, and that's kind of one of the reasons we're in the spot that you're in. So I hope we can, on a bipartisan basis, move forward and really find an answer on this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have a 40% increase in spending for our health care bill. We've done 1.75% for long-term care. I really do hope that we can move our priority in the right direction. You know, we can point fingers at the governor, but the fact of the matter is that the legislature brings a package to the governor and negotiates with him or brings it back. What came back to us, and actually we tried time after time again to put an amendment on in the House floor to bring at least 5% to long-term care. It was knocked down time after time. It's just a matter of priorities. And so I hope that we can work together in the way that we're all hoping to do and put some money in, but I'll tell you, it's too late. We should have done last year.
And that money was from the Health Care Access Fund, which we heard testimony tonight. We want to keep used for the purposes they're supposed to be used for, or from dedicated federal TANF funds, which with the state of Minnesota, I think, putting our state at risk financially, has been playing around with those funds for the last 4 years, doing some gamesmanship with the books. So, in any event, but I think we have a disagreement here, and we can move on that. I think we do are committed on a bipartisan basis to trying to figure this out.
And in light of that, I guess one more point that I know was brought up on Thursday, there was one graphic in there that talked about the difference between what was appropriated for long-term care and what was actually disseminated. And you see from year to year that there's also been, that is, I think it was about $47 million, if I'm right, over the last 4 years. I think it was probably about $8 million just last year that there was funds appropriated but did not actually get disseminated. And I'm not exactly sure what happens, but from that discussion, it sounds like that money is going back in the general fund. And that.
What happens there is we make projections. And federal budget is based on projections of how many people are going to be in nursing homes. Mm-hmm. And for the last several years, we've actually over-projected the number of people. So at the end of the day, the money that actually gets sent out to nursing homes, the rate doesn't change. So you don't see any more money per person, but there's not as many people there to get the money, and so that money then disappears back into the budget. It's when we don't account for it separately so that we can recapture that and reinvest it. And that's another thing that we're thinking about trying to do in the next, kind of as a budgeting mechanism in the future, so that if we actually have fewer people accessing services, we can increase the funding per person so we have more money per person and actually spend all that we decided to allocate. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's kind of a budgeting issue as we just, because our projections were, that's what happens.
Makes sense. But from an operator standpoint, sometimes I'll project higher numbers so that I so that I can try to make them pay for the company. And so yeah, maybe that's a tool to use, like you said, not have it be a per person, but if you can get the total fund, find a way to anything will help.
Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Chuck Ness for the Minnesota Rural Health Fund.
Hello.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you all for coming out here. It's greatly appreciated that you to come out to the rural areas for us. My name is Chuck Ness. I'm the CEO and president of the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative. We're based in Granite Falls, Minnesota, but we have members all over western Minnesota. In a moment here, I'll rattle off some of the counties that are where we have membership. Frankel Watch and Benson Hospital is one of our members. I'm also have been and will be again one of the board members of the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance. Been involved with that since the beginning, so very very supportive of that. We have kind of a situation that I'll be approaching you shortly on to for your assistance. We were formed back in the mid 90s, 1995. Under the Healthcare Reform Act and the statutes of 62R. And that allows us, the Minnesota Rural Health Co-op, to, among other things, to work on behalf of independent healthcare providers. Our initial members were hospitals, clinics, and public health entities in the region. Later on, public health dropped off because they couldn't own stock in the organization. Later on, in 2005, we added pharmacies, rural pharmacy, because of their financial situations going on. Well, before I get into it, maybe I'll mention where some of our members are so I'll give you an idea of where we're at. Largely a rural, very rural organization. We have members in in these following counties: Manoman, Grant, Traverse, Swift, Hope, Stearns, Big Stone, Lacaparo, Yellow Medicine, Lincoln, Lyon, Murray, Redwood, Renville, Brown, McLeod, Meeker, and Kandy Ohi. I think I'm missing one or two, but as you can tell, we're kind of big area, a lot of members. Affiliated Medical Center is kind of in all those areas. They're not a member of ours, but a lot of other folks are that are out there. Like I say, we've been in business since 1995. One of our main services that we're providing our members, the reason we were formed is in the mid-90s, HMOs were starting to come out into the rural areas again. They had been in the cities, obviously, for a long time before that. This was actually the second attempt to bring managed care out to western Minnesota. And it's really, managed care is a numbers game, and there just aren't enough numbers out here for commercial insurance. But they were coming out here, but at that time, they were choosing not to even engage or offer contracts to smaller entities, like Benson, for example, maybe Wheaton or Madison or Appleton, you know, various smaller communities. Wilmer was getting contracts. At that time, I was an administrator in a clinic in Montevideo. We were offered contracts. Marshall, I suppose, would be offered contracts. But a lot of the other members out in that area just weren't. They just didn't bother. You know, it wasn't worth their time coming out to contract, but they wouldn't even mail a contract out. They were just going to say, no thanks. We're just going to concentrate on the bigger centers. Well, you can imagine what that meant to those folks. They were saying, well, all we're going to be is Medicare and medical assistance, and you just can't survive with that. At that time, we didn't know that, had we known that managed care wouldn't really last very long, it probably wouldn't have been as frightening. But we used this law to form the cooperative. And we started, one of the first things we started doing is contracting. We're successful in contracting with, I think we have 12 or 13 contracts like Medica, Health Partners, UCare, Preferred One, all of the major contracts. For a while we had Blue Cross, actually Blue Cross. We started out with risk-based contracts for the law, and then later on that law was changed so we could do regular indemnity insurance, which we've done. And what we do is we provide a benefit to our members by being able to, first of all, everybody's included. It's kind of an all or none type of a deal. And then we also do delegated credentialing, where we do the credentialing piece on behalf of our members. So they fill out one form, and then we have our own committee that reviews it and then determines if they're good enough, and then we provide that to all the health plans. But if we do it one time instead of these 12 health plans doing it 12 different times, and it's a major deal. I mean, it might not seem like much, but it is. And also, because part of it, too, is they do site visits to the facilities, and we do that once instead of 12 times, and it's less disruptive. But it's one of the other benefits from that is, again, kind of what we're dealing with the health plans, where health plans sometimes would cherry pick, where they would say, I want you, but I don't want you or you. And now for us, it's like, well, everybody, unless there's a valid reason why, you know, this shouldn't be included, they are by default. And so one of our big goals was to have access to health care in rural Minnesota, and that was accomplished. And we also have very high standards. One interesting situation we learned kind of, again, by default is we did have some health care providers that we didn't approve. And we're wondering, well, how did these health plans, how were these people credentialed under these same health plans we had, but they were credentialed outside of us before they joined us? You know, this physician would come to the area. Well, it turns out that a lot of health plans don't contact references, which is interesting. We do. And, you know, for a physician to say a negative reference on another physician, there's a problem. So I found that very interesting that health plans usually don't check references.
And when you say you didn't approve, what is that?
Well, what happened is, and I don't want to get into the specifics of the confidential thing there, but it was, we just said, you know, this physician. What happened is that they weren't going to be part of our group. They were part of one of our members, so what they did is they withdrew his application. But it was, there was a problem. And, but they were already, it was interesting because they were already credentialed before they got to us. So I found that very interesting. So basically, I mentioned that because we're also very interested in quality. We just don't want anybody coming out here, and we make sure we do our homework on that. So, you know, it's the other benefit we give to the health plans, which is very apparent, is, you know, we have a very large area, and a lot of our members are fairly small. They can do a single, of our membership in all those areas, we have 23 critical access hospitals, 35 primary care clinics, and 10 specialty clinics. Those are individual organizations. The primary care clinics might have multiple satellites, so we're, I think we're talking like 70 locations or more in the clinics. So, you know, we do the site visits, we do the contracting. They do a contract with us. It covers everybody, all the clinics and hospitals. You know, it's a little bit of a negotiation, but once that's done, they're done. You know, I mentioned Blue Cross, which we're more than happy to deal with when they want to. It's kind of when they want to, they come to us. But, you know, they've been real hesitant. They just soon keep it on one-to-one with our members, and that's fine. Part of the 62R is if the members or the health plans don't want to work through us, they can. They can go outside. You know, we'd rather they not because it kind of defeats our purpose, but that's fine. You can do that. Well, Blue Cross came to us 2 years ago because they were having difficulty signing critical access hospitals up on their Medicare Advantage programs. Well, they came to us. We had 23 of the 83, I think, critical access hospitals in the state. We negotiated something. Actually, the deal ended up still direct with Blue Cross and the members, but we were able to act as the liaison and got an acceptable arrangement. I can't remember the details, but it wasn't a big deal. But they trusted us and had worked with us for years, so both organizations came to an agreement and, or, you know, the individuals. So that was Elgard. The reason I'm here, though, is I want to bring something to your attention that's been a problem for us lately. And I mentioned in 2005, we had, you know, if you think back of what was going on then, the pharmacy was start getting a taste of the, what's the name of that? Oh, I'm blocking it. It's the Medicare D. And you probably know what that means for the independent pharmacies. And they were starting to come out, and again, it was, the rates were so onerous that a lot of our independent pharmacies just simply said, we can't do this. And the PBMs are very aggressive negotiators, I mean, beyond aggressive negotiators. And the reason we got involved and invited them into our organization, they approached us, pharmacies did, and, you know, a lot of our hospitals also own nursing homes. and the local pharmacist, if they aren't in the network, they couldn't see their patients. So there was a major problem. And so that's why we finally said in April of 2005 we invited them into the cooperative. Well, in June of 2005, we started negotiating on behalf of our pharmacists to the PBMs. And in July of 2005, we believe Prime Therapeutics went to the Federal Trade Commission and said, we don't want to deal with these people. So in July of 2005, the FTC sent us a letter. And that's what started a 2.5-year trek of dealing with the Federal Trade Commission. At our peak, we had 71 pharmacies all over the state, which, you know, if in the grand scheme of things, I think it's like 10%, if that, of the pharmacies in Minnesota. They were all rural pharmacies, not exactly market dominance in any stretch of the imagination. Yeah, antitrust. Yep. And that's something that, and again, with the 62 R's, I understand that we have an ability to negotiate as a group. So we were acting under that. The short story of it is, basically, the Federal Trade Commission doesn't respect the 62R legislation as being enough. You know, their feeling is that the federal law trumps state law, and you know, there's some other issues there, but it's really minor. What it comes down to is in September of 07, they sent us a consent decree that they asked us to sign. Again, it's kind of negotiating by here it is, sign it, or you're in big trouble. So we looked at that. The board felt we had no choice. We had E&O and D&O insurance, but it, unfortunately, did not protect us against this. So we're on the hook for all the legal fees, and we just said, you know, we can't do that. We just can't defend ourselves. So even though we feel we've done nothing wrong, we are stuck. Well, we were about to sign and voted to do so, actually, November 16th of this year. But we were working with another attorney from Washington, D.C., who's formerly from Minnesota, who has a lot of experience in this. Well, and we also were dealing with people from Congressman Colin Peterson's office, Robin Gorecki. Some of you may know her. And the feeling was, at that point, kind of a last-minute thing, is we're thinking that, and this was something we talked about in the very beginning, but we didn't pursue it because the FTC kind of shot us down and scared us off. But we were thinking, what we're looking at now is pursuing the, what's it called, state action immunity. And that what that is basically is what we had, or what we thought we had, under 62R. And so what our plan is, our hope is, and that's why I'm going to be contacting you all separately later, is in the next 2 months, is we're asking for time. Actually, today we sent a letter to the Federal Trade Commission. So if you heard a small explosion, that was probably the attorney in Washington, D.C. getting that email. And that's probably what happened. Anyway, it will not be pretty for the next few weeks. But what the plan is we're going to be researching that and seeing what kind of language to do to the 62R to beef it up to where we thought it was supposed to be in the first place. But apparently the FTC feels they need to make it so it's okay to do what we believe the state wanted us to be able to do from the beginning. So that's really what it's about. We think we're doing good work. Again, we've been involved with these folks for a long time. We're not dealing with any big organizations. I mean, hospitals, they're all critical access. You know, I don't know what to say, but that's what we're about. And again, we were even, Greg Thorson and I were talking just about a month ago, you know, this kind of activity here. We're wondering, one of the things we were looking at doing, Greg didn't mention it, but we considered in the past several years with the West Central Purchasing Alliance is doing the Accountable Provider Network. And we believe that this kind of interaction or interference from the FTC might preclude us from even attempting that.
Tell me about
The Accountable Provider Network, and Greg could probably help out on that a little more, but as I understand it, it's a way for the providers to negotiate directly with the consumers.
Oh.
Well, we're accountable to, you know, we're basically doing our own deals with the people, and we'll bypass the health insurance aspect altogether. Is that kind of correct? There's other risks involved in that, but, you know, that's something we'd be interested in pursuing if that's a possibility.
Now, there's some discussion of ideas like that at the Capitol right now.
Yeah. But like I said, we've been at the table with what might seem a little odd dealing with, you know, trying to, you know, we're concerned too, having, again, one of our missions is the access for patients. And if it's unaffordable and people just aren't coming in, I mean, nobody wants that either from a provider perspective. So, but anyway, that's our story that we're dealing with right now. And frankly, if we do sign the consent decree, which if all else fails, we will do, because we figure we'd have no choice, but it might hurt us enough that we may not be able to continue.
So that's, please do let us know on that language that you're using. And, so you can contact any of us, I suppose, for me. If you want to talk to Aaron, we can work on that. That'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you for raising that issue. Something I wouldn't have any idea about.
Okay.
That's really helpful. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.
The last person on our written agenda are folks from the Swift County DHC. You want to come on up and tell us a little bit about what you're working on? Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to address you. My name is Emma Quadden. I am the director of the Swift County DAC here in Benson, and also the Stevens County DAC in Lawrence, just 25 miles up the road. And I thought what I would do, first of all, is just give a very brief overview of DTNH services, because I come to see that there is quite a bit of confusion sometimes about DTNH services for the disabled people. And then I have a few issues that I would like to discuss with you. The DAC here in Benson is serving 27 clients, and the one in Morris serves 65 clients. Overall, in Minnesota, there are 275 licensed DTNH programs, and there are almost 14,000 people served at those programs. The purpose of the DAC is to teach and assist our clients to become as independent and as self-sufficient as possible, and to help them become active members of the community and, if possible, to hold jobs in the community. And the way we do this, well, because we are a day program and not a residential program, we focus on things that people would do during the day, with the greatest emphasis on job training and job procurement. But we also provide community orientation, various therapies, basic client care, depending on the needs of the individual. And while all of the DACs in Minnesota are somewhat similar, we're all licensed under the same licensing rules, we vary because the people we serve vary. Some programs are very, very strong on community work. Others are located in places such as Alexandria, where they have a lot of industry, and so they have a lot of opportunity for in-house work in their workshop. Some places have more people with very high needs in wheelchairs that need feeding and diapering, those kinds of disabilities. And so it just depends on what the clients are and what they're offering their clients. But in most instances, most programs, and certainly the one in Benson and the one in Morris, is made up of a combination of all three of those things. We have as many people working out in the community as we possibly can. We also provide work at our workshop because many of the jobs that the people hold are not full-time jobs. To be very honest, if they were capable of holding full-time jobs and being financially self-sufficient, they probably would not be in our programs. And then we also have the part of our program where we deal with people with very strong physical disabilities, people that have no communication skills and need diapering and feeding and very basic care. Currently, there are over 6,000 businesses in Minnesota that employ the people from DACs. And last year, the people in DACs earned almost $50 million. So it's a significant cooperation between the DACs and the businesses in Minnesota. And about 60% of the people at the DACs are holding jobs out in the community. So I don't know if you've got any questions on that, but what I did for this small DAC that's just serving 27 people. Okay. Thank you. Both of these. We listed the jobs that are currently being performed, or this year were performed or are currently being performed by our clients. And just to give you an idea of the variety of things that we're doing with these folks.
They're all residing
in Swift County. But because of residential programs, some people are not originally from Swift County, but they're all living here in Swift County at this time. And this community, and I heard this said by some of the other people that presented here today, they have been extremely supportive with this program. The city of Benson has been extremely supportive. Some of the businesses here, we've done work for some businesses such as Red Ball for years and years and continue to get a variety of jobs. But so I can't say enough for the support that this community has given us.
What kind of work do you do in your at your facility? Do you enter contracts with? How does that work?
Yes, we enter contracts with various businesses, and some of them are listed there. And usually contracts, we have some that go long-term. For instance, we've packaged garbage bags that are used by residents of the county for years, and that's ongoing. But Red Ball might call us and say, we need you to package springs. Or we need you to put O-rings on something that's used for the corn planter. And that might last for 3 months, where we're very, very busy with that, and then they're done with that for a while, and then we go and do other things. And the priority job is always getting people out in the community to work at those jobs. But very often those jobs are something where a person might work 3 hours a day, 3 days a week. And then they need some place to come back and work when they are done with that job. I mean, it just depends. Some people might work 2 days a week. Some people might work every morning out at a job in the community. It just depends on the individual.
How much of your budget is, because you must generate some of your budget from the contracts you have?
Actually, we do not.
You don't?
Well, I shouldn't say that we don't any. Here in Benson, probably, I'm guessing, maybe 2% of our budget, very little. Our hope is that we break even on this because we have to pay, what we're doing this work for is the clients. It's for them to get paid for the job that they're doing. And we do make a little here, but it's really not much. Actually, in Morris, we've been going backwards because we have to abide by the federal wage and hour laws, and so we have to pay our people a certain amount, and we've been actually going backwards a little bit there. So all we hope to do at the DT&H level is to make sure that we don't go backwards too far. We want to meet our expenses.
So what is your budget based on that? Where does it come from?
What
are the sources? Yeah,
it is. Our budget is entirely made up of tax money.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mainly medical assistance. There are some county dollars as well, which leads me to our issues.
Okay. There you go.
First of all, the COLA, and I'm bringing that up first because it's the one that you're the most familiar with. Funding is the big issue. It has been the big issue. We are under the same funding guidelines or the same stream as the nursing homes. We're included with them. When we got our 2% the 1st of October last year and this year, that was the same as the, well, basically the same as the nursing homes. And as you know, since 2003, inflation has raised by 12.77%, and the DT&H service providers received in those 4 years only 3.53%. And I noted with interest, for instance, the university, we had people that were striking up there because they were only offered 2.5, I believe, when their counterparts that were teaching were offered 3.5. And I agree with them. I mean, they definitely had an issue, but then I see the long-term care providers getting 2%, and it just shows the disparity that is going on. So I've already heard you say that long-term care is a priority for you, and I was very happy to hear that. We really do need the money. Also, when they were talking about health care issues, I do know that there are many DACs across the state that have stopped providing health care coverage for the DAC workers. And I know that that's true just down the road in Starbuck and also in Hoffman. I don't know about all of the others, but it is definitely a problem. The next issue that I wanted to touch on is waivered services. The waivered service slots. We've got currently over 4,000 people on waiting list right now to receive services at DT&H facilities. Over 4,000. And we believe, of course, that if a person needs services, they should be able to receive them. If a student came to the public school and said that he wanted to enroll and we told him, sorry, you'll have to wait at home until there's money for you to come, we think that was absolutely crazy, but yet that's happening with people that need DT&H services. And in fact, I had two people in my program within the last couple of years where the counties took services away from them simply because of financial reasons. One person was denied services altogether. She had been a full-time client. And the case manager said, I know she needs services, there just isn't money. And this was a person that had a diagnosis, a dual diagnosis of MRMI, in other words, developmental disabilities and mental illness, and so they were able to do that. But that person really needed services. Another another person that we are currently serving had been there 5 days a week, and was cut back to 3 days a week simply because of the funding. And again, if we had a student and we told them, sorry, you can only come to school 3 days a week, we think, what? But yet this kind of thing is happening to these people that do need services. Transportation. Our transportation rate structure was developed over 30 years ago, and that was back when programs had one van and they'd go to one group home and pick up 15 people or whatever and drive them over, and they'd stay in the program all day long. People that lived at home would maybe ride the school bus, and the school was donating that service. That's what the transportation rate is based on, and we've been getting these little 2% and 3% increases over the years, and it's just not adequate. Now most facilities, both here and in Morris, we have 6 vehicles. They're going all day long. We're using the public transportation as much as we can. We have buses coming and going all day because not only do we have people who have varied schedules as far as when they come to our program, you know, we've got folks that are coming half days. We've got folks that are coming 3 half days, that sort of thing. But mostly we've got people that are going to jobs. And we have to have our own vehicles for that because we don't always know when they're going to be done cleaning the ball field or when they're going to be finished washing dishes somewhere. And so we've got our own vehicles, and with the price of gas, well, you know, it's just not working for us. So we really need to have a boost as far as our transportation costs.
Do you think it makes sense to keep that transportation rate as a separate stream of funding as opposed to...
Well, it all goes into the same pot.
No, I understand.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know. But the good thing about it is that it addresses it so it doesn't get just lost. But...
okay, so you're borrowing from your other rates.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. The 24-hour rule. And I don't know if you're familiar. We call it the 24-hour rule, and that's what I've always heard it referred to as. But it was established years ago, recognizing that it is not good to have one entity taking care of a person 24 hours a day. It's good to get that person out of the home and have other eyes see him or her and to interact with him, because otherwise you're just setting the person up for the possibility of abuse or neglect. If they're just being watched by one person, it's so easy to have that person neglected, and who will ever know? Especially with the people that have no communication skills or people that are very severely disabled, they could sit in that home for years. And who's coming in to see what's going on with them? Are they being stimulated? In fact, I know you're familiar with that case with Jesse Anderson a couple years ago where he was actually dead in a home for 3 days before anybody realized that, and supposedly he was getting programming. Well, that, unfortunately, is, well, what can I say? It's a terrible thing. But I'm afraid that if that kind of thing would be allowed to happen, where people can stay in their homes all the time, that there will be a lot more abuse and neglect. Well, the law that was enacted years ago said that people had to get out, people that lived in ICFMR group homes. What has happened is that we don't have very many ICFMR group homes anymore. They're all going to four-bed homes or little apartments or something like that. And so the law doesn't pertain to people anymore the way it did. And
so
I believe...
So that law doesn't apply to the law.
No, right. It only applies to ICFMR. And so there are some people that are saying that we should just abandon that and that people should be able to just stay home. In fact, there's a very small but vocal minority that thinks that perhaps we should do away with day programs altogether. People can just stay at home during the day, and they can go to their jobs if they want to, but then just go home. Well, first of all, I wonder, what jobs? Where are they going to get these jobs if there isn't a day program? And certainly, how are they going to be able to keep them? But let's say that they can do that. Again, I say most of these people are only working for, you know, 2 hours a day, you know, 3 days a week or something like that, if that. And that is not going to happen if they don't have someone working with them to set this up. I believe that these people, it's vital for them to leave the home, go out to a day program during the day, go to their jobs if they're capable of doing that, but get out and see other folks and have a viable program during the day. And it's just very important that that happens. Another thing is, I have seen on days that we are not in session that our folks sometimes end up sitting in front of the TV all day long. And that's what I predict will happen if this is allowed to be. One of the things that I do want to point out is that this small but vocal minority is also saying that day programs are a result of the state institutions closing, and that we have moved our people from a state hospital, a large institution, just into smaller institutions. And that really is not the case. Day programs were developed years before the Welsh Decree. The DAC here in Benson was in operation for 9 years prior to Welsh. The first several years that I was a DAC director, all of the clients, 100% of the clients in Morris and in Benson, were people who lived at home with their families. Those are the people that started the day programs. The parents and the professionals that saw that having an individual stay in his home all day long was not a healthy thing. And we even had a couple of people over in Morris that had occasional part-time jobs. There was a guy that did go and help at the elevator during spring's work, help load bags of seed corn and fertilizer, that kind of thing. And a woman who helped do dishes at the nursing home. She was unable to keep that job. And the fellow that worked at the elevator, his job was just so seasonal that most of the time he was at home. And so his parents and her parents were some of the people that started the DAC. And they have said to me many times over the years that they are so pleased with the services that we provide. Nobody is sitting and watching TV. We are keeping people busy with meaningful work all of the time. And if we would stop that, it would truly be a step backwards. I also would like to address subminimum wage situation. All DACs hold subminimum wage certificates, and that's a certificate that the Department of Labor allows us to have that will allow us to pay people according to their productivity. We have folks in our programs that can do the work, but they can't do it as fast as a person who can earn minimum wage. But they maybe can do it fast enough to earn $2 an hour rather than $6.15. And this subminimum wage certificate will allow us to have that person doing that work. Now, if we have to pay that person $6.15 an hour, he's not going to have a job because he's just not able to work even close to that rate. Again, there are some people out there who would like to abolish the subminimum wage certificates because they say everybody should be able to earn a living wage. Well, we certainly agree that if people can earn a living wage, we certainly want them to do that. And some of our folks in some areas have been able to earn more than minimum wage on certain jobs. And now with the jobs that are coming out as far as doing the data processing, that's getting to be a new thing. Some of those people are able to earn quite a bit more. But for the most part, people just are not able to earn as much as minimum wage if they're in a DT&H program. And so I think it's critical that we're able to keep that going so that these people actually can hold jobs. Otherwise, I'm afraid they will lose them. The last talking point that I have is the property tax, sales tax situation. And I'm sure you've heard this. It just came up in the last week or so that the Supreme Court has ruled that many of the nonprofit organizations have lost their tax-exempt status as far as property tax and also then sales tax. And so if we're in a situation where we have to pay property tax on our facilities, we just don't have any extra money, and that would just really do it to us as far as both as far as the property tax and the sales tax.
I know the tax committee is looking at that decision very carefully to figure out what to do around that. Okay. That has really wide range of implications.
It does.
Any questions, members? Well, thank you for sharing. This is really helpful. And it is amazing work that your organization and others around the state do. I mean, it provides a lot of help to a lot of people. So thank you for doing that.
Yes. I do have some brochures here also from NDAC, our student organization. Thank you.
Is there anyone else that's interested in sharing anything?
Elliot Nelson, I think I put him down.
Okay. Well, why don't we go here, and then if you guys want to come on up. But no, you can. Yeah, please. Thank you.
Hi there, members of the committee. My name is Chris Yard. I'm a senior at the University of Minnesota Morris. Over the past year, I've worked with Greg Pleasure Thorson on a study on rural homelessness, and we found a lot that related to issues of health care, and I think it'll be important to share these.
Yeah, please.
First off, one of the major things we found.
Can you first display your name?
Chrisyard.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. Of course. One of the major issues we found was that a lot of people became homeless when they hit upon a major unexpected expense, oftentimes from healthcare expenses. I also brought up by some of the earlier speakers about how one major illness, one injury, can really knock out your entire savings. Next thing you know, you can't make your mortgage payments, and you're out on the streets. And we're talking like just regular, upstanding members of the community in these cases. Another issue we found was a lot of people that became homeless had addiction problems and chemical dependency issues, and at the same time this is going on, a lot of our small towns are losing their ability to give treatment. So, for example, Stevens County Medical Center had to recently shut down their rehab programs. So now if someone in the Morris area is in need of chemical dependency treatment, they have to be shipped either down to Wilmer or St. Cloud, or some other place where they're away from their friends, away from family, and any sort of support network, which a lot of studies have shown can really make a major difference in whether someone will relapse or not. And we're also very similar to that with mental health issues. A large number of people have become homeless in both in rural communities and non-rural communities are dealing with mental illness and other mental health problems that are not being properly addressed by the current healthcare system. And with the limited resources that our rural hospitals have, it's again an issue of exporting the problem, where people that fall in hard times or have hard times become them are shipped out to a lot of times to other communities. And this is bad for rural communities in and of themselves because that's fewer people in the community, less local government aid. If they have a family they have to move out, that's less children in the school district, so overall less funding. And I know we'll have a full paper coming out at some point in the future on this, on our research, that we'll have some policy recommendations of it.
That'd be great. First of all, you can send that whenever you get it. You can send it to me or to our staff.
All right.
That'd be great. Do you know why the Stevens County?
They couldn't afford to offer the program. They work with the community, and at one point they were looking at getting rid of it earlier, but the community and Stevens County government was able to pay more money for the program. But it still wasn't able to they still weren't able to make it financially solvent for the community.
Well, yeah, we're having our next hearing, which is going to be back in St. Paul, is going to be on chemical dependency issues. And, one of the things that we hear a lot about is because the state hasn't been doing quite as good a job funding those programs as maybe we should, the variation by county is very much based on property tax now. Availability of those services varies tremendously across the state, and so that's one of the things we're going to be spending some time up to this very time and it's helpful to hear.
Great. Are there any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Sure. Liz Elk, Countryside Public Health, and it's Joint Powers of Big Stone, Chippewa, Lac Parle, Swift, and Yale Medicine Counties. I do want to thank you for the freedom to breathe. The second thing I want to thank you for is I am so used to driving to St. Paul, so now you guys have the long haul back, and I don't.
Or Rochester.
Yeah, so I want to thank you for coming. I think what I wanted to hit on, and I'm not going to get into the big public health thing, because that's not why we're here, but as Aaron Peterson knows and the newspaper guys, I can talk about anything if I get a mic. What I did want to tell you, though, is I do think we have a health care insurance industry problem. And I know we're not in a fiscal budget year, but I think it's a conversation you need to have because the example I want to give is I am the employer of 30 female employees paying $230,000 to carry health care coverage. And basically my pool is 30 women. And no matter what happens, you almost hope and pray none of them end up in the hospital because if they do, then my health care costs skyrocket and I go from $230,000 to $300,000 in a year. So what I'm saying to you is we have a health care insurance problem. My husband's a state employee. Guess what happened? My health insurance went from $500 a month that I paid, just like you, to $100. And I was almost embarrassed to talk to my employees. I felt like I, as the administrator, shouldn't say to my employees, I have insurance for $100 a month because I'm a state employee in a pool of $10,000, but I live in a rural area with a pool of $30,000, and now you're going to pay $500, and I'm paying $100, and I have full dental coverage, and you have nothing. So I'm just saying, what I wanted to say and not take a lot of time is we have a health insurance crisis, whether we're rural, metro, whatever we are, that pool, a monopoly, pharmacies getting, you know, just the whole thing, the whole network, and we need a conversation up on it. And so I just hope that we can continue that conversation, because I know next year I'm going to be paying a huge amount for health care, and I got to pay for that, but it's going to come out of taxpayer dollars, because I'm a governmental entity, so someone's going to pay for it, and it'll either be property taxes, or we come back begging from somebody else, and so it's a conversation we need to keep having, and I want to thank you guys for coming out. I really appreciate that because I know what the drive is like. So thank you very much.
Well, and
the situation of 30 women. I have a.
You don't need to put that in the paper either.
I don't need to call this in Rochester, and heaven forbid, one of our employees gets pregnant. That's considered a disease or whatever, and your rates go up for pregnancy, which is very normal.
Which is a wonderful thing.
Right,
it's a wonderful thing. And yet I have two women, the same thing. It's a wonderful thing, and I want to say that, and I see her, and I want to go, oh, great. But yet I'm looking like, oh, I hope you don't have any problems, and I hope nothing happens. And so I just think when you look at the pool and what they're talking about with the rural cooperatives, it's a bigger conversation, but I think we need to have it, and I think we need to keep talking about it because it's not going to go away, this health care issue. So thank you so much for your time.
Well, just on that point, I did we skipped over someone.
I'm so sorry.
No.
I'm really sorry.
But I do want to say on that point that we've actually spent the summer and fall working on healthcare reform in St. Paul, and kind of at the heart of that conversation, it really, as we've talked it through, it's become clear that the issue of affordability of health coverage is kind of the central issue. And so we've talked with them. So I expect that we'll be coming forward with a pretty bold proposal. They get that cost containment because that's part of it. They get that some insurance reform, some of the things that were talked about tonight, to allow people to kind of create bigger pools and make sure people get into pools and a whole variety of things. And then I think one place we may end up is setting up a standard in Minnesota that if you don't have to spend more than this percentage of your income on health insurance and figure out a way to get there. Because the issue of affordability for small businesses and for individuals and for a variety of, for everybody really is kind of at the heart of this discussion. So you really framed that issue up nicely.
Thank you.
So, introduce yourself.
My name is Elliot Nelson. I'm going to speak briefly here today because my sister is who I'm a legal guardian for is one of the clients at the DAC here in Benson. And she's been there since it opened, back in the 60s. In the past year, she's probably done everything on that list that you see in front of you. Everything from working on the line at Red Ball to mowing a city park to painting a fire hydrant to working at the recycling center. She has starting to have limited mobility because of arthritis and some other problems. She has cerebral palsy. Many things that would take somebody else down. She keeps on plugging away, partly because at the end of the month she gets a paycheck for that work that she did, and that's her most proud moment, to be able to take that home, buy some clothes, buy a gift for somebody. I'm sorry, I'm just getting a little emotional. I sat on the school board here in Benson for about 14 years, and in that time, we went through many changes. We had outcome-based education. We had grad standards. Now we have No Child Left Behind. We have lots of grandiose programs that take lots of staff time, lots of expense, take money away from the students. Here we have an opportunity to keep something in place, the Developmental Achievement Center, that's working. And we need to do that. Let's not mess with something that works. So, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Do you want to? That's right. Anybody else? Sure. Go ahead. Yeah, why don't we? This one, yes. I'm Deanna Steckman, and I'm with the Swift County Human Services. I'm the director there here. And the issue that I would like to put before you is county-based purchasing for human services agencies. To be able to have some local control and then have community reinvestment once the profits are there for the nonprofit. And so it's just a brief moment. I just want you to know that we have 13 counties out in this area that are looking at attempting to become county-based purchasing. And if we are to go online by January 1 of 2010, we only have until October of this coming year to get all of our complex applications put together. And then there is 15 months, and we won't know until DHS and MDH make their final decision, maybe a month before we would go online. And so we can go through all this work and not have anything come of it. And so I'm just asking that we, in Minnesota, allow that, what the Medicaid laws already allow, but that it's not... that's not how it comes out of the state agency. So. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Deb Schneider. I'm an administrator at Minnewaska Lutheran Home and Starbucks. And I just wanted to kind of bring out there that the quality add-on for the nursing homes that we had was very minimal. We were very lucky to get one of the pay-for-performance grants through Care Ventures, which is 17 nursing homes together. But I was wondering if you guys are working on some quality initiatives to make that quality add-on better for people that are doing quality work, so we can continue to do better and better and better, so that that makes a difference, not just the cost of living raise across the board for no matter what you're doing, but for the quality add-on component of it, for doing it well. So I was just wondering if you guys could touch on, I mean, it was such a very small percentage last time that it wasn't even worth doing quality work. You got it no matter what, almost.
Well, I mean, I think that that's, I wish Bob Hope was here.
He's probably ripping apart. I'm glad he's not.
That's coming from the case. I mean, I think part of the reason this year was that the, you know, the 2% wasn't particularly as rehearsed tonight that big. And so that was kind of a minimum that everybody was going to need. And so what are we back about 0.15 off of that?
Well,
to go to the quality piece. I mean, I think that's interesting to hear you say that, because we often hear just the opposite. And
right.
That's capital for many nursing homes.
Granted, but when, you know, we focus on the quality, which is why we went for a pay-for-performance grant, to make people stronger, for you guys to pay less for it. But in order to keep doing that, we need your support on that.
That doesn't do it for you. Kind of is irrelevant, is what you're saying.
Right, because that pay-for-performance grant goes away in 2 years for us. After that, we still need to keep that up. So I hope you guys focus on that.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Anyone else? Well, thank you. It's 7 o'clock anyway, so it's about time to wrap it up. So thank you very much for coming. It's really been great, and it's kind of, you know, one of the themes we keep hearing tonight and in other towns that we've gone to is how supportive the communities are of all of our different facilities that you end up, whether it's a hospital or the nursing home or what have you. And that was clearly evident today at our visit to the hospital and testimony there. So thank you for all the work you do. And if you have any questions, obviously, you know how to get a hold of us. There's your man. So thank you very much. We're adjourned.